Chapter 13. Every man has his weakness, if you can find it. Jameson's was so obvious that it seemed unfair to exploit it, but Sadler could not afford to have any scruples. Everyone in the observatory regarded the young astronomer's painting as a subject for mild amusement, and gave him no encouragement at all. Sadler, feeling a considerable hypocrite, began to play the role of sympathetic admirer. It had taken some time to break through Jameson's reserve and get him to speak frankly. The process could not be hurried without arousing suspicion, but Sadler had made fair progress by the simple technique of supporting Jameson when his colleagues ganged up on him. This happened on the average every time he produced a new picture. To steer the conversation from art to politics took less skill than might have been expected, for politics was never very far away these days. Yet, oddly enough, it was Jameson himself who raised the questions that Sadler had been trying to ask. He had obviously been thinking hard, in his methodical way, wrestling with the problem that had concerned every scientist, to a greater and greater extent, since the day when atomic power was born on Earth. "What would you do," he asked Sadler abruptly a few hours after the latter's return from Central City, "if you had to choose between Earth and the Federation?"
"Why ask me?" replied Sadler, trying to conceal his interest.
"I've been asking a lot of people," Jameson replied. There was a wistfulness in his voice, the puzzled wonder of someone looking for guidance in a strange and complex world. "Do you remember that argument we had in the common room when Mays said that whoever believed in my planet right or wrong was a fool?"
"I remember," Sadler answered cautiously.
"I think Mays was right. Loyalty isn't just a matter of birth, but ideals. There can be times when morality and patriotism clash."
"What started you philosophizing on these lines?"
Jameson's reply was unexpected. "Nova Draconis," he said. "We've just got in the reports from the Federation observatories out beyond Jupiter. They were routed through Mars, and someone there had attached a note to them. Moulton showed it to me. It wasn't signed, and it was quite short. It merely said that whatever happened, and the word was repeated twice, they'd see that their reports continued to reach us."
A touching example of scientific solidarity, thought Sadler. It had obviously made a deep impression on Jameson.
Most men, certainly most men who were not scientists, would have thought the incident rather trivial, but trifles like this could sway men's minds at crucial moments.
"I don't know just what you deduce from this," said Sadler, feeling like a skater on very thin ice. "After all, everybody knows that the Federation has plenty of men who are just as honest and well-intentioned and cooperative as anyone here. But you can't run a solar system on gusts of emotion. Would you really hesitate if it came down to a showdown between Earth and the Federation?" There was a long pause. Then Jameson sighed.
"I don't know," he answered. "I really don't know."
It was a completely frank and honest answer. As far as Sadler was concerned, it virtually eliminated Jameson from his list of suspects. The fantastic incident of the searchlight in the Mare Imbrium occurred nearly 24 hours later. Sadler heard about it when he joined Wagnall for morning coffee, as he usually did when he was near administration.
"Here's something to make you think," said Wagnall as Sadler walked into the secretary's office. "One of the technicians from electronics was up in the dome just now, admiring the view, when suddenly a beam of light shot up over the horizon. It lasted for about a second, and he says it was a brilliant blue-white. There's no doubt that it came from that place that Wheeler and Jameson visited. I know that instrumentation has been having trouble with them, and I've just checked. Their magnetometers were kicked right off scale 10 minutes ago, and there's been a severe local quake."
"I don't see how a searchlight would do that sort of thing," answered Sadler, genuinely puzzled. Then the full implications of the statement reached him.
"A beam of light?" he gasped. "Well, that's impossible. It wouldn't be visible in the vacuum here."
"Exactly," said Wagnall, obviously enjoying the other's mystification.
You can only see a light beam when it passes through something. And this was really brilliant, almost dazzling. The phrase Williams used was, it looked like a solid bar. Do you know what I think that place is?
No, replied Sadler, wondering how near Wagnall had got to the truth. I haven't any idea. The secretary looked rather bashful, as if trying out a theory of which he was a little ashamed.
I think it's some kind of fortress. Oh, I know it sounds fantastic, but when you think about it, you'll see it's the only explanation that fits all the facts.
Before Sadler could reply, or indeed think of a suitable answer, the desk buzzer sounded, and a slip of paper dropped out of Wagnall's teleprinter. It was a standard signals form, but there was one non-standard item about it. It carried the crimson banner of priority. Wagnall read it aloud, his eyes widening as he did so.
Urgent to Director Plato Observatory. Dismantle all surface instruments and move all delicate equipment underground, commencing with large mirrors. Rail service suspended until further notice. Keep staff underground as far as possible. Emphasize this precautionary, repeat, precautionary measure. No immediate danger expected.
And that, said Wagnall slowly, appears to be that. I am very much afraid my guess was perfectly correct.
It was the first time Sadler had ever seen the entire observatory staff gathered together. Professor McLaurin stood on the raised dais at the end of the main lounge, the traditional place for announcements, musical recitals, dramatic interludes, and other forms of observatory entertainment. But no one was being entertained now.
"I fully understand," said McLaurin bitterly, "what this means to your programs. We can only hope that this move is totally unnecessary and that we can start work again within a few days. But obviously we can take no chances with our equipment. The 500 and the 1,000 centimeter mirrors must be got under cover at once. I have no idea what form of trouble is anticipated, but it seems we are in an unfortunate position here. If hostilities do break out, I shall signal at once to both Mars and Venus, reminding them that this is a scientific institution, that many of their nationals have been honored guests here, and that we are of no conceivable military importance. Now, please assemble behind your group leaders and carry out your instructions as swiftly and efficiently as possible."
The director walked down from his dais. Small though he was, he seemed still more shrunken now. In that moment, there was no one in the room who did not share his feelings, however much they might have inveighed against him in the past. "Is there anything I can do?" asked Sadler, who had been left out of the hastily drawn-up emergency plans.
"Ever worn a spacesuit?" said Wagnall.
"No, but I don't mind trying." To Sadler's disappointment, the secretary shook his head firmly.
"Too dangerous. You might get into trouble, and there aren't enough suits to go around anyway. But I could do with some more help in the office. We've had to tear up all the existing programs and go over to a two-watch system. So all the rotas and schedules have to be rearranged. You could help on this."
That's what comes of volunteering for anything, thought Sadler. But Wagnall was right. There was nothing he could do to help the technical teams. As for his own mission, he could probably serve it better in the secretary's office than anywhere else, for it would be the operational headquarters from now on. Not, thought Sadler grimly, that it now mattered a great deal. If Mr. X had ever existed and was still in the observatory, he could now relax with the consciousness of a job well done. Some instruments, it had been decided, would have to take their chance. These were the smaller ones, which could be easily replaced. Operation Safeguard, as someone with a penchant for military nomenclature had christened it, was to concentrate on the priceless optical components of the giant telescopes and cilostats. Jameson and Wheeler drove out with Ferdinand and collected the mirrors of the interferometer, the great instrument whose twin eyes, 20 kilometers apart, made it possible to measure the diameters of the stars.
The main activity, however, centered round the 1,000-centimeter reflector. Moulton was in charge of the mirror team. The work would have been impossible without his detailed knowledge of the telescope's optical and engineering features. It would have been impossible, even with his help, if the mirror had been cast in a single unit, like that of the historic instrument that still stood atop Mount Palomar. This mirror, however, was built from more than 100 hexagonal sections, dovetailed together into a great mosaic. Each could be removed separately and carried to safety, though it was slow and tedious work, and it would take weeks to reassemble the complete mirror with the fantastic precision needed. Spacesuits are not really designed for this sort of work, and one helper, through inexperience or haste, managed to drop his end of a mirror section as he lifted it out of the cell. Before anyone could catch it, the big hexagon of fused quartz had picked up enough speed to chip off one of its corners. This was the only optical casualty, which, in the circumstances, was very creditable. The last tired and disheartened men came in through the airlocks 12 hours after the operation had commenced. Only one research project continued. A single telescope was still following the slow decline of Nova Draconis as it sank toward final extinction. War or no war, this work would go on. Soon after the announcement that the two big mirrors were safe, Sadler went up to one of the observation domes. He did not know when he would have another chance to see the stars and the waning Earth, and he wished to carry the memory down into his subterranean retreat. As far as the eye could tell, the observatory was quite unchanged. The great barrel of the 1,000-centimeter reflector pointed straight to the zenith. It had been swung over to the vertical to bring the mirror cell down to ground level. Nothing short of a direct hit could damage this massive structure, and it would have to take its chances in the hours or days of danger that lay ahead. There were still a few men moving around in the open. One of them, Sadler noticed, was the director. He was perhaps the only man on the moon who could be recognized when wearing a spacesuit. It had been specially built for him, and brought his height up to a full 1.5 meters. One of the open trucks used for moving equipment around the observatory was scuttling across toward the telescope, throwing up little gouts of dust. It halted beside the great circular track on which the framework revolved, and the space-suited figures clambered clumsily aboard. Then it made off briskly to the right and disappeared into the ground as it descended the ramp leading into the airlocks of the garage. The great plane was deserted, the observatory blind, save for the one faithful instrument pointing toward the north in sublime defiance of the follies of man. Then the speaker of the ubiquitous public address system ordered Sadler out of the dome, and he went reluctantly into the depths. He wished he could have waited a little longer, for in a few more minutes the western walls of Plato would be touched by the first fingers of the lunar dawn. It seemed a pity that no one would be there to greet it. Slowly the moon was turning toward the sun, as it could never turn toward the earth. The line of day was crawling across the mountains and plains, banishing the unimaginable cold of the long night. Already the entire westward wall of the Apennines was ablaze, and the Mare Imbrium was climbing into the dawn. But Plato still lay in darkness, lit only by the radiance of the waning earth. A group of scattered stars suddenly appeared low down in the western sky. The tallest spires of the great ring wall were catching the sun, and minute by minute the light spread down their flanks, until it linked them together in a necklace of fire. Now the sun was striking clear across the whole vast circle of the crater as the ramparts on the east lifted into the dawn. Any watchers down on Earth would see Plato as an unbroken ring of light surrounding a pool of inky shadow. It would be hours yet before the rising sun could clear the mountains and subdue the last strongholds of the night. There were no eyes to watch when, for the second time, that blue-white bar stabbed briefly at the southern sky. That was well for Earth. The Federation had learned much, but there were still some things which it might discover too late.